listeners, just want to give a content warning that we talk about sexual assault and self-harm in this episode. Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly. And today in our ninth episode, we're going to talk about Ruin and Rising by Leigh Bardugo, the final installment of the Grisha trilogy. What did you think, Jessie?
Okay, so Ruin and Rising started out really promising. I thought I was going to love it. It was exciting and fast paced. And then in the middle of the book, we got back to travel story. And it felt really similar to Shadow and Bone. And that's when I became bored and disinterested. And I feel bad saying that, but it was a bit of a letdown in the end.
I hear you on the, especially on the circular plot structure that brings us back to the, basically the same movements that we saw in Shadow and Bone. But for me, there were a few aspects that really kept me going and kept me intrigued. First, villain backstories. Love that. Sucker for that. And second, I couldn't look away from the Darkling's increasingly violent tactics. I kept wondering how far he would go in his quest for power and domination. And finally, and most importantly, for me personally, the deep exploration of Alina's affinity with and connection to the Darkling. I eat that shit up.
Yeah. I just wasn't here for it. I was like, no thanks.
It's time to talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe.
So much traveling around. I know that's like a world building thing, so we get to see new places, but I was just like, oh, so bored.
I think we might have a pattern. You don't like travel / quest narratives at
I
all.
I don't think I do. I never finished The Hobbit.
Which is like half of YA.
Yeah, I think because it happened in the first book, by the time we get to the third book, I was like, I don't want to do this again.
That's a fair point.
I thought it was boring. Just too much traveling.
Jessie wanted more action.
Yeah, that's the thing. I want more action. We get Nikolai being really awesome and cool for like 2 minutes, and then he is turned into a weird demon monster. He's my favorite, and I was like, Alina and Mal are kind of boring, so like, I want to know more about Nikolai.
Agreed. Thanks, King of Scars.
I know, I'm really excited.
I didn't mind the traveling around that much. I liked seeing these other parts of the Grishaverse that Bardugo integrates into Ruin and Rising. We see the tunnel network in the White Cathedral, also the Spinning Wheel Enclave, that like old pilgrimage site that in the mountains in Fierda that Nikolai converts into his home base for his rebellion or whatever. We also saw the cute southern city, like Balakirev, and the mystical forest / mountains of the Sikrzoi. I kind of like seeing the different geographic locations in a fictional world.
I liked the spinning wheel and I liked the tunnel parts, like when they were traveling through the tunnel and when they were in the White Cathedral. But after that, the rest of the places seemed similar to places we had already been, and I was just, yeah.
Not convinced.
No, I don't know why. It was just similar.
I would say that most of the world building was based on visiting different parts of the map,
right?
Shall we say.
Which I guess kind of makes sense since Alina is a map maker. That's going to be most interesting for her as a character to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But not for me to read about.
And also you do all the traveling and then realize you didn't have to do it in the first place.
Yeah, they're going to look for the Firebird, and then it's like the Firebird's not even the thing. Mal's the thing. The thing's been with you the whole time. Ugh. So tropey.
You don't know it until you know it.
No, I know. I get it. But I was glad that they found the Firebird. I'm glad that it was a real thing.
Yeah, that was cool. And I liked the moment with Mal and the Firebird. You really got to explore Mal's connection to nature, basically.
And then I felt a little bad that Alina was second-guessing her relationship with Mal because he's an amplifier, worried that he, like, their connection was, like, this false thing, kind of.
And it was just destined to be, and they weren't actually, like, objectively, quote-unquote, in love.
If that's an objective thing.
And it's not.
It's not.
Objectivity is a myth.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool to and sad to look at, but I was also like, whatever.
Wands out.
This is the segment where we discuss all things magic.
In Rune and Rising, we get a much clearer picture of what Merzost is. We only get suggestions of that in Siege and Storm. Storm and Siege?
Can't remember.
Don't even remember. It's one of the two. And we also see the consequences of it. So Merzost is what when Grisha tamper with what they call the making at the heart of the world. And Bagra thinks that her unique power is a direct result of her father, Ilya Moritsova's experiments with Merzost. Also, the Darkling creates the Shadowfold and the Nichivoya with Merzost. We also learn that Mal's unique power is the product of Merzost.
I'm not convinced that Bagra's powers are the result of the Merzost. That didn't seem... Maybe it would have been good if we got more of her backstory from a different perspective, which I guess would be kind of difficult, because we don't really get any of... there's no way to know for sure where her power comes from.
We just know what she thinks is true.
I'm thinking of, this kind of reminded me, and funny enough, a book that you have not read. So I know we did City of Bones, but in the fourth one in that series, we learn a lot about Valentine and some experimentation he did. And that kind of reminded me of this. I can't tell you what, but
I think that's also part of it is Bagra's almost internalized self-loathing because her power is what made her different and what made her mom hate her and what, you know, made her life basically miserable.
Right.
And her being an outcast for forever and just, you know, being so lonely and hated essentially by everyone. And so it makes sense that she would trace that experience to some sort of abomination. I mean, you're looking for the reason behind it rather than just suffering happens.
At the end of the story, a bunch of the non-Grisha have Grisha powers. Is there a reason why some of them have it and some of them don't?
I don't know. I think it just cause kind of random, maybe.
Okay. I was kind of confused why some people all of a sudden were summoners and some people didn't seem to be. That was kind of confusing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do we get more in Crooked Kingdom or whatever?
It doesn't. It's not about Grisha really that much.
Interesting.
It's not about Ravka anyway.
Oh, okay. Cool. Mal is the third amplifier. I did not see this coming, and I know I've been saying that I thought something was going on with him
for the
last two books, and I was really glad to be kind of right. But I did not think that he would be a descendant of Morozova, and I really, really did not think Alina would kill Mal to gain the power of the third amplifier. I was shocked. That was really exciting. Really exciting part.
I thought it was interesting. Oh, interesting. That Alina, it makes sense that Alina was convinced that she was the other descendant.
She wants so bad to be special.
But I like that she just seemed to come out of nothing.
Right.
I think that's better rather than just tracing power through hereditary lines.
Oh, like in Star Wars.
Exactly.
New Star Wars.
Right. I don't want Rey to be some sort of child of some magical Jedi, super strong people. I just want her to happen.
Right. Yeah. And I really liked that she had, she didn't really have any powers that came from anywhere for any reason. But Mal did and didn't realize it, which was also really cool.
And I liked that we saw him when he said that he made David put a beetle in the blasting powder.
Right.
And that's how he knew where to throw it and shoot or whatever. It's because he could track the beetle. I don't know. I think it was really cool to see his relationship with nature. I wish we could have gotten into
POV or something.
Or I wish we would have that there was space in the narrative and the story for exploring how cool that could be and how rich and generative and lovely.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the story's not. There wasn't really that much room for that.
No. And I mean, the book was still over 400 pages long and it didn't feel long to me, which I know sounds ridiculous because I was bored for a bit, but it didn't feel more than 400 pages long. Onkat was my favorite character of all three books. I really liked Onkat and Harshaw, and I really felt because the Grisha are often talked about as being witches in Fyrda, I thought it was interesting to think of Onkat as Harshaw's familiar, And I was really sad when Harshaw died, but I was glad Aunt Kat was able to stay with Misha. Misha was also just like the cutest character. I like them both.
I'm curious if like one Grisha power could be communicating with animals.
Yeah, I don't know, because he he talks to Aunt Kat as if he's a person, and like Aunt Kat seems to know what's going on.
Aunt Kat certainly seems more sentient than other animals we've seen.
I guess we don't get to see that many animals that actually interact with our characters like in a meaningful way. We see Alina kind of have an interaction with the stag, but I guess that's really the only one, right?
Yeah, I would say so. And then the firebird thing at the end, the sea whip.
Yeah. And Aunt Kat's the only pet.
That's true. We do get the story, the book starts with that myth about the worm that supposedly made all the tunnels.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, maybe there are more sentient animals in this. A sentient, I'm going to put that in quotes, like more communicative with people. Mm-hmm. Kind of cool. I liked Aunt Kat because I love cats. I was worried that he was going to die at the end.
Not surprising.
Or she, I don't know what kind of, I don't know. I don't know. But I'm glad he didn't. She did not.
I bet they went on to live a full life.
I hope so. Nine lives.
Nine lives. I just want to nerd out for a second about how cool Grisha magic is. I think this is an awesome magical system that's like manipulating quantum mechanics. I think that's rad. And then when Alina makes people slash things appear invisible, I thought it was like she's messing around with photons and how photons, like literally the smallest parts of matter, interact.
I have to say I didn't read the full acknowledgments at the end, but there was something in there about how that making things look invisible is actually possible in the real world, in our world, and like the science behind how that can work.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting. I don't always read the acknowledgments.
I mean, the only reason anything looks like anything is because light reflects off of it.
Right, right. Like that's how we get different colors. And
I thought that it got super sciencey with that David Alina combo.
I wish we got to see more of David making things. His magic seems maybe like the best to me.
And then when Jenya and David pair up.
Yes.
Which is pretty cool.
Yes, because Jenya, I think in the first book, we're supposed to see her as like her beauty is what gives her power and makes her magical, like her ability to manipulate that. But she's obviously a genius. She's working very closely with David to make all these things.
Her power, she made her power herself.
Right.
Like no other tailors had existed before, I didn't think.
No, I don't. We don't see any other ones.
And then what's cool is in Six of Crows, then you see how that particular strand of Korporalnik magic gets taught to students.
Oh, well, I'm excited.
There's a Korporalnik in Six of Crows.
Okay.
And she uses that power, which is cool because then it's like, oh, a woman literally made up a new field of magic and now gets to teach it.
Good for you, Jenya.
I know. It's rad. I had this aha moment about Bagra on the reread for this book, for making this episode. I realized that the reason she's so frail is because she purposefully suppresses her power. So if she used her power, then she'd be like all young and beautiful like the Darkling.
I did not get that at all. Wow.
Is that convincing to you? Is that persuasive?
Oh, yeah. I think you're 100% correct because she's older than the Darkling, but probably not by that much. And we never see her use her power except for the one time.
Yeah, a very few times. Mm-hmm. And then when I think it's, she's just like so much more powerful than her son. Like all of the Nichivoya followed her off the cliff. And I just thought that that part was a really good scene.
Which is also a little frustrating because rein in your kid, man.
There were literally hundreds of years when you could have intervened and you didn't.
And you did nothing. I get it because it's like this thing where you love your kid so much that you don't want to punish them, I guess.
It's kind of selfish, though, if you let them wreak havoc on an entire country.
Like committing genocide, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, rein it in, Bagra.
Step up.
Yeah.
And to be fair, she does sacrifice herself at the end.
She does, which I also did not see coming.
Nope.
I mean, I don't know what else she was supposed to do if Alina's the only one who could save everyone.
And I got the feeling that from Bagra's story that when she says to Alina that most of the really powerful Grisha end up having to commit suicide because they can't die otherwise. Right. They can't be killed. I was just curious if there were more of those types of Grisha way back when.
Right.
Because it seems like the Darkling is the only super powerful one. Maybe they just hide.
Or maybe they don't have such a greed for power that it will turn them into, you know, darkness. It is interesting, though, because not just in this book, but in other books and TV shows that I watch, you encounter, like, a lot of vampires, and you don't often see them kill themselves. And they also are immortal beings.
Yeah, that's because they can live in community with one another.
That's true. But the Grisha can. They do, kind of. I wonder, I guess.
But only certain ones are immortal.
Right, that's true. And I guess Bagra grew up in a time where being Grisha was not, like, accepted. So that would be kind of difficult.
I thought it was a little easy and convenient that the one with the shadow power was the villain. That darkness, again, has to be equated with villainy.
Right.
And lightness and whiteness, white stuff, is equated with heroism.
Even Alina's hair turns white.
I don't know. I'm just not convinced that darkness in and of itself is a bad thing. Like, light literally wouldn't be a thing if darkness didn't exist.
Well, not only that, I think it's something that some YA novels do is make things too convincingly black and white, like good and bad, as opposed to a middle ground where some people are kind of bad or kind of good, and sometimes you might root for a quote-unquote bad character.
And I think that there were threads of that throughout this series in this novel, but it wasn't fully fleshed out.
Right. I could have used more. Because while we do get Bagra's background story, we still don't get that much about the Darkling.
Wands away. Speaking of the Darkling, now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in a segment we're calling Get Me Kylo Ren.
Let's start talking about the Apparat. The Apparat is a priest who knowingly sells a false prophet to gain power. And I saw this as a commentary on religion, as a false sense and a false sense of piety and devotion from its leaders, and on the way that we should interpret sainthood if priests are using their relationships with the saints in order to elevate themselves. And I thought this really brought into question the stories, not just that we get, but that were in the book of the saints and how they, like, gain their quote-unquote sainthood.
I think it definitely, this dynamic shed some light on the, I guess, complex dynamic. I don't even know what I'm saying. I think that the Apparat storyline and the the sun worshiper, saint worshiper storyline shows this great divide between faith and institutional religion,
right?
Or religious institutions, rather, and that people who want to gain power by creating religious institutions or rising to the top of religious institutions really exploit the faith of the followers, and they manipulate people. And those followers are depicted mainly as, the Apparat sees them as, like, ignorant,
right?
And totally easy to like convince and sell things to.
And I guess we see that a little bit in the, what are they called? The Soldat Soul. Mm-hmm. Because there's those 12 people who leave the Apparat, even though they say they escaped from the Apparat in order to come help Alina. Because he wants to use her while she's around as a way to give himself power, but he doesn't want to lend her help when she needs it the most.
Another thing the Apparat's behavior makes me think about is how specifically religious institutions and people affiliated, you know, in the higher echelons of religious institutions can pretend that they're above, in huge scare quotes, the lowbrow concerns of politics, but they're actually playing both sides and being really sneaky about using all of this political dealings for basically personal gain.
Yeah. And I mean, we see that a lot in religions where the people in charge end up being the most rich in the community, even though it goes against what their own religions say about wealth, while their followers are, you know, there's a really good John Oliver about, what is it called?
Oh, the televised, yeah. Televangelists.
Yeah, the televangelists.
And they'll, like, send us your seed.
Yeah, the seed, like, sowing your seed, which is something, like, from the Bible, but they have taken that and used it as a way to make themselves rich. I would highly recommend watching it because don't send your money to people you don't know.
And it's also hilarious.
Yeah, give your money to charities, people in need.
I don't know, but I think it's okay to, like, compensate individual Black women, for example, doing consciousness raising on social media.
Oh, that,
or like Native,
for sure,
people.
Yes, but maybe not religious leaders who own, you know, mansions and helicopters and boats.
Who basically can, you know, do televised commercial.
Yeah, religion, commercialized religion.
Aprette was one of the main villains for me, unequivocally.
Alina is. I think sometimes I want my heroes to do some more bad things. If I was Alina, I probably would have killed the apparat and, like, showed the people how he was, like, a false priest, because she really doesn't. There's no ramifications for the apparat. And then I'm guessing we'll see him more in King of Scars, because now he's going to be working with Nikolai. I really did not like that.
I don't think we've seen the last of him. I agree.
So we get a little bit of David and the ramifications of hunger for knowledge and what knowledge can do / be in the wrong hands. Specifically, David is trying to recreate Morozova's Lumia. Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
And he leaves the, like, recipe for it, and the Darkling uses that against them later on the Fold.
I think it basically is a fictionalized account of the weaponization of science.
Right.
Like, you gain scientific knowledge and you learn about, I don't know, atomic power, and then you make a bomb.
Right.
And just about how there's no knowledge is, how it's used is almost more important than what it is in and of itself.
Right.
And I think the book implies that there's a line somewhere that humans cannot and should not cross when it comes to creating and manipulating life. And in this, like, in the quest for power, that line comes into, not quest for power, in the quest for knowledge, that line comes into sharper focus, and there's supposed to be a moment when you decide not to cross it and you choose not to do the next thing. I mean, kind of Merzost is like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but where that line is continually up for debate and renegotiation. And this, it directly relates to contemporary fields like bioethics and ethics of robotics and science and technology studies. They all engage with these questions. And I actually think about it a lot because it comes up in my dissertation research.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding is there's no easy or definitive way to answer what is too far.
Right.
Because the landscape of what's possible is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you supposed to make those sorts of determinations?
Well, not only that, at what point are you supposed to stop yourself from seeking further knowledge in your field? You know, because you're right. We don't know what's possible until we have made it possible. And that, I'm not really sure. I don't think David did anything wrong other than maybe leaving his notebooks, but he was on the run. So I don't know.
And I think and he was also super surprised when Alina came at him with those questions. And I think it's because he didn't think to weaponize that knowledge.
And I guess people don't. They don't think about, I think sometimes people don't think about the ramifications of what they're doing and how that can create such a terrible problem.
And especially, like, once you create knowledge, especially in our contemporary reality,
right,
you don't really have control over where it goes.
No, especially if you're publishing your work. It's just out there on the internet. Like, you can find how to make terrible things on the internet. And there's no way to really stop people from getting that knowledge. I'm not sure that it should be possible.
It's not easy to determine. I mean, there are things that should just, you know, lines that you shouldn't be crossed, but who determines what those are? What are the criteria? I don't have the answers to that.
Yeah, me either. Whatever I say, that's what should be right.
Speaking of villainy, what the Darkling did to Nikolai was awful.
So bad.
I particularly this plot twist more than any other was something I didn't see coming. I was curious what you thought about it.
It was a little heart-wrenching to me because I like Nikolai so much and because he's such a fun-loving kind of outward, and I don't know, he's just like a really good character that I love so much, and he's got a great personality, and I'm a little terrified to see how this will change who he is as a person in King of Scars, because I'm not sure this is something he's going to come back from. What do you think?
I think that this was an excellent, really great move on Bardugo's part as far as character development.
Yes.
Because this gives Nikolai a whole other layer. Like, he's going to have to mine the depths of his evilness, basically.
Right.
Which he was able, it just gives him some more gravitas and weight behind where he was usually trying to be more playful.
Right.
And I think it's just going to give him this other layer of experience and emotion, which I think was necessary, because sometimes he was a little flippant.
Right.
And he's not going to be able to do that. And we kind of see a little bit more of this added component to his person at the end when he's talking to Alina in their like private meeting or whatever.
Right. I'm just scared that he will lose that playfulness and like sense of humor. And I'll feel really bad about that. I don't know. I really like Nikolai.
Well, I think he's going to have to project that still. Because he's going to pretend that nothing's wrong. Because if anyone found out.
Right.
On a grand scale, what happened to him.
Right.
Then I'm sure they'd be a little bit more hesitant to accept his power.
Yeah, and his rule as king. Because it's been a rumor for so long that he was a bastard child. And he knows it for sure. And I'm guessing that's also going to come into play. Him knowing for sure that the king was not his father. Which, like, it doesn't matter. Who cares?
Who cares? That guy was an asshole.
Yeah, he was the worst, and I don't think we have anything to say about the king.
Oh, I go off on it later.
Okay, good. So on page 259, Alina is talking about the Darkling, and she says, how could someone be so cruel and still so human? Which I think Alina is trying to make the case that humanity exempts a person from cruelty, but I think that's a terrible thing to do when all the evidence of humanity proves that humanity is real shitty and terrible and cruel.
Literally read a history book.
I know. I was so frustrated with Alina with her views on the Darkling in this book. Yeah.
I think he's a pretty complicated character, but what this quote really points out is this, how humanity as in like the Homo sapiens.
Right.
The history of this species has been marked by violence since the beginning, and in particular since basically colonialism exploded.
Right.
Like 500 years ago. But yeah, I don't understand how humanity, like in humanism and humanity in the like moral sense, are just equated with goodness.
No, I don't either.
When in reality, that's basically avoiding the other 50% of human impulse.
Well, and it's strange too, because Alina grew up in a war-torn society that, like, the Shuhan and Fjerda and Ravka have been at war her whole life. So what good in humanity is she seeing on a day-to-day basis that makes her think that? Also, Alina on the Darkling and what he's done, she says on page 400, for all his crimes, the Darkling loved Ravka, and he'd wanted its love in return. No, I do not accept that excuse. Intentions do not make up for actions. I was really, really frustrated with Alina at the end that she almost seems to be giving the Darkling a pass for everything he's done.
I don't think the Darkling loved Ravka. I think he wanted to be loved by Ravka and its people, but when that couldn't happen, he opted for power and being feared. And it's honestly a pretty textbook Machiavellian dynamic. Is it better to be feared or loved? Ideally both. But if you can't do that, then fear is the more effective way to keep and gain power. I think that Alina, it's easier for her to make those sorts of excuses for him because she feels the drive to exert her power no matter the cost or the consequence. So I think that she understands in a way that no one else does that it's possible.
Right.
That like lots of the kernel of that sort of awful possibility is within her.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why she's able to make those sorts of comments. I'm not really convinced by them. Personally, I don't find them persuasive, but I think that's probably why she has that ability to go to make that logical jump.
At the end of the book, we see Alina dealing with the death of the Darkling and everything that's happening and losing her powers. And I felt bad for her at first. And then she is trying to kind of, it almost feels like, justify what the Darkling did. And she was sad for his loss. And I just was not on board at that point. And it made me, I was like frustrated with her. Like, I wanted to like shake her and be like, what is wrong with you? Like, he killed all these people. He's been doing terrible things for maybe thousands of years. And you're just, I don't know. I was like really annoyed.
I guess I didn't find that as annoying. I maybe should. Maybe that means I'm a bad person. But
I don't think you're a bad person if you didn't feel this way.
I think that she's grieving.
Right.
Because she was, when they both had power, he mm-hmm. was the only person who she really could connect to on like a visceral level.
Right.
Who could really understand her in a certain way mm-hmm. and this certain part of her that is like this power and this hunger for using it. So I think that she's, like I said, grieving and doesn't have anyone else to do that with, but also grappling with the awful things that he's done.
I think the problem is I don't think the Darkling deserves her grief. He's like a murderous dictator. I don't feel bad for them.
That's true. Like, to be fair,
when Hitler dies, people don't feel bad that he's dead, and if they do, they're bad people. Hitler's the easiest example, obviously, to use in this case.
Well, when you put it in those terms, I'm really questioning myself and my own feelings.
I'm so sorry I made you question everything.
For this fictional character. I don't know. I wasn't as upset by Alina's.
I think I was just annoyed with her the whole time, so it makes it easier to be annoyed about other things. And I'm just like, what the fuck are you doing? That's how I feel.
I found this persuasive as far, like, I could understand why she was having really complicated and problematic emotions about it.
And I could not.
There we go.
We disagree. We interrupt these deep cuts to bring you Show Us Your Fix. Which character do you think deserves their own storyline? Let us know by finding us on Twitter or Instagram at JKMagicPod.
Do you have opinions about this?
Well, I want Nikolai, and we're going to get King of Scars, so I'm A-okay.
You're good?
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I kind of just want Nikolai.
Maybe Jenny and David, because his like confession of love for her was real sweet, and I was like, oh, that's cute. I wish we could have seen you guys together more.
Yeah.
But yeah, if y'all got some Jenya David fanfic, I would read that.
Okay, back to the deep cuts, because just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, gender, etc. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. We're going to start off talking about some gender dynamics.
Mal protecting, quote, protecting Alina from killing anyone. Like, let her do her thing. He's like jumping in front and killing people on her behalf.
I don't like that.
I didn't either. Also, I wanted to see Alina kind of struggle with the idea of having done something that maybe she will regret later, because we don't really see that much of her feeling a sense of regret for any of the actions she took to save everyone else.
Just that one. She uses the cut on that one guy who was going to kill Mal.
Right. Yeah, of course. Then it's okay. So I don't know. I don't need to be protected on some dude's behalf so that I can't kill someone. If I want to kill someone, I should be allowed to kill him.
Not Jesse's real life. I wonder what a story, how bloody a story would be if you were the protagonist of a YA novel.
It would be bad. I kind of am concerned that, like, in Game of Thrones, I would be Cersei. Like, if I'm being honest with myself, whatever. No regrets. We also see Alina as a woman in charge, and no one seems to have a problem with that. And I'm wondering if you think that in this world, power seems to be more important than gender of the person in power? What do you think?
I don't really think so, because if that were the case, I think we would see more powerful women. There's a king, the king-queen dynamic in Ravka seems like the king has power, the Apparat's a dude, the
Darkling.
Darkling's a dude, Nikolai, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you're probably right.
All of the Aprichniki seem to be dudes. All of the priest guards seem to be men.
I'm wondering why no one has any, like, takes any issue with Alina as a woman.
I think it's only because she's so singular, because she's a sun summoner. I think that's the only reason.
Do you think it's because she's a saint? I guess she's not even the only saint we see that's a woman.
But I think the Apparat is able to write her off more because she's a woman.
Mm, yeah, you're probably right.
And keep her silenced more because she, and manipulate, I don't know, just like keep her subjugated and oppressed more because she's a woman.
Right.
And because, and she does make comments about he wants her to be all motherly. I think that as a woman in charge, when you wrote this, one thing that made me think of is that is this part in the Sikrzoi when Alina's hesitant to grieve alongside her friends and allies, but Mal encourages her to be open with the others about her emotions, which might be Mal's only good advice. But then that also makes me think that, let's be real, Mal can give this advice because when powerful men shed a tear, it's like a fucking noble miracle and people eat that up. I mean, obviously toxic masculinity has issues and men should be allowed the full bandwidth of emotions.
Of course.
And that also sucks. But when women cry, it's seen as a sign of weakness.
Right.
Particular, and it's like reason to write them off as like hysterical or overly emotional. But in any case, I appreciated this scene because it depicts a woman's emotions as a sign of her strength rather than a sign of her weakness.
Alina taking care of Misha was super adorable to me. Like, I know he's just going outside and she's like making sure he's got a coat on. And I thought that was really sweet. And I was wondering if you thought this was supposed to be juxtaposed to Bagra as a mother, because she doesn't seem to be like depictions we would think of as like a quote, like mothering mother. You know what I mean?
I think there's certainly a opposition there. I'm not sure if it's specifically supposed to be a commentary on motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Bagra kind of seems more like the Anakuya style.
Yes.
Motherly figure.
I just thought it was interesting because they're both seem to have some sense of responsibility around Misha in particular.
Yeah. I guess we also see Mal taking up some of the responsibility for parenting.
Which is good. If there are two parents involved, they should both be equally involved.
Agreed.
Although you do not have to have two parents. That's also okay.
I want to segue into class by way of gender, because intersectionality is a thing. The revelations about Jenya's role poisoning the king really throws this intersection of gender and class into sharp relief for me. So Jenya literally poisons herself in order to hurt the man who repeatedly sexually assaults her. And the fact that she resorts to self-harm and playing this long game of poisoning because they are her only possibilities for justice just shows how fucked up this patriarchal system is, essentially. But that's not even the extent of the fucked upness of this situation, because when Jenya is forced to relive her trauma in front of an audience, like the hero, Dr. Blasey Ford, the attacker isn't held accountable. Nikolai takes a chicken shit stance of banishing his father and making him abdicate the throne, only threatening the king with a rape trial should he refuse to do so. A trial which I'm sure would have found the king not guilty, because that's how patriarchy works, aka by protecting rich cishet white men at the expense of literally everyone else. But living out your days in luxury on a colonized tropical island without anyone knowing about your misdeeds is not justice. And you know what else isn't justice? Nikolai saying he'll make Jenya stand trial for treason because of poisoning the king. Like, what? Fuck off.
Yeah.
And even in fictional worlds like the Grishaverse, the carceral system unjustly and disproportionately affects the lower class, and the system is not equipped to hold men accountable for violence against women.
I was really surprised that Nikolai didn't take a stronger stance. And that was really disappointing.
But he thought he was taking a strong stance. He thought he was being just. That's what really gets me. It's like, no, that is not justice.
No, not even close. And then Jenya is supposed to feel grateful when she gets a pardon. She didn't do any, like, she was protecting herself. I was, like, really frustrated with that. Nikolai, get it together. I really like you, so, like, get it together, please.
That's why, I think that's why his actions that aren't up to my standards are more frustrating than other characters, right? Because I like him so much.
I wonder if we'll see him kind of deal with the ramifications of this and how maybe he is not holding the king accountable, because while it's not the same as rape in any way, shape, or form, he was also, like, forced into being / doing something he didn't want to. Like, he was violated by the Darkling in a very different kind of way. And I wonder if that will come back to Jenya in some way in the next book in King of Scars.
Yeah, that's a good point, because Jenya did a lot of those. The book seems to imply that Jenya did these things on the Darkling's orders, but I also, listening, because I listened to the audiobook, and the mm-hmm. performance of that scene was, like, really good. And then also the, like, I'm not ruined, I'm ruination. Like, right. I just want a tattoo.
Do it.
I don't know. I think that this was a really good moment for her character. And I'm just like, fucking A, Nikolai.
Are we supposed to understand that part of Jenya's, I don't know, her, like, scarring and stuff? Is that are we supposed to know that came from the poisoning?
No, the scarring was just because the Darkling tortured her.
Okay.
And she said in her, like, little speech thing, she says that she had to heal herself. So okay. That's part of her Corporalnik and Taylor.
Okay. I wasn't sure if some of that came from the poisoning, and because of whatever the Darkling did to her, she couldn't heal it after the fact. Like, couldn't mm-hmm. keep up with the, like, mask of whatever did that. I was a little confused. I should have just reread it.
That's okay. On to race. There is, I think, a suggestion when we hear or when we see the Bagra and her son Alexander storyline, them being shunned as unnatural by everyone, even the people in the Grisha community, that I was curious if you think that this might be a way of showing how discrimination can work even within marginalized communities.
You know, I, funny enough, wrote down nothing for race this time, which is odd, but I did not think of that at all. But I think you're probably right, especially when we think of things like light skin privilege within the Black community. I think in other communities, like in Brazil. So, yeah, I agree with that.
Or about how, I don't know, I guess maybe if you are differently abled mm-hmm. within a particular marginalized community,
yeah,
that means you have further barriers.
Right. There seems to be some kind of, I don't want to say hierarchy, but I guess some kind of discriminatory thoughts or feelings within, like, the gay community as well. Like, maybe as if, like, being bisexual is not as good or as, like, right as being, you know, gay or lesbian. You see that kind of, like, discrimination a lot. So I guess maybe all marginalized communities have some kind of system of judging others that...
Maybe there's this just... I don't know if it's, like, a human impulse towards mm-hmm. sameness in right. order to be in community together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah. But that's really... can be frustrating and ostracizing and honestly, like, has really violent consequences in this particular fictional example.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't really think about that, but we do see that. And I guess even within the Grisha themselves, they kind of created a hierarchy based on their powers. So, which I guess Alina is trying to combat.
Another thing that made me think about race in this novel, in this series, is since we've been talking about the Grisha versus non-magic people as, like, an example of different races and them being interacting with one another, could we think of Alina inadvertently spending her privilege, to use Brittany Packnett's phrase, by creating a bunch of other sun summoners and giving up her own power?
I think so. I obviously, as I said before, was a little confused about who got those powers.
Non-magic people, obviously.
Right, but there didn't seem to be any distinction for why some people got them and why some did not.
It seemed like maybe just like a question of proximity.
Oh, do you think that's what it was?
When she did the thing.
Oh, okay. Did the thing.
Technical term.
Yeah. So I guess I could see that. Because the other thing, too, is by the end of the book, Alina has none of that privilege anymore. Maybe that's what you got to do. Spend your privilege. Get rid of it.
I think it got flipped to where, I guess, Alina's power is more directly connected to whiteness because of, like, the literal color of her power.
Right.
But there's not a direct parallel to white supremacy, I don't think, in this novel, because in Ravka, or in the entire Grishaverse, people who are magical were oppressed, and the Darkling is the one who actually made Ravka up over centuries of machinations and manipulation and obviously violence, but also like political dealing,
right,
and sacrifice on his own part made that a place where being Grisha didn't mean that you got burnt at the stake or like vivisected.
And in some ways elevated them above the non-Grisha. Alina literally becomes a saint. I don't know what's more elevated than that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I guess like at the end, finishing this novel the second time made me realize that in this series, it's not a very simple parallel, like a racial parallel between like what's happening right now.
No.
In our world.
Especially not what we've seen in like other books that we've read.
Right.
This one is, I think it's a little difficult too, because we have very few POC characters in this book.
Absolutely.
Makes it hard.
This is a new sub-segment called Bodies and Minds.
Yeah, I didn't really know what else to call this, because it deals with both those things, I guess, kind of.
Perfect.
Jenya believing that her looks are what give her power and status at the beginning of the book was really sad. And
that's how you internalize that patriarchal beauty standards.
I know. And I was really glad that by the end of the book, we see her completely turn it around and decide that how she looks has no bearing on whether or not she's powerful and useful or worthy of being a person.
But the other frustrating aspect of that is she really only seems to come to that realization after David's profession of love.
Yeah. You don't need another person to make you, you know, worth being a person.
Yeah, I agree.
I guess it's kind of hard because it is how we as people live our lives in community with other people. And sometimes when you feel like you don't have like your people, then you kind of do feel worthless. So I get it, kind of.
Right.
I wish it wasn't like just straight love story.
Mm-hmm. In any case, I'm glad that she learns to appreciate herself.
Me too. You don't need both eyes to be beautiful.
Nope.
Or any eyes.
Mm-mm.
Sergei has PTSD after watching Maria die. And I feel like we haven't seen this kind of depiction of kind of a mental breakdown in any of the books that we've read previously.
And what's interesting is that Alina seems to be the only character that actually approaches him with empathy and compassion and doesn't really seem to blame him
right.
for his betrayal, I guess.
Well, and I'm not sure that you can. Sergei obviously is going through something really difficult, and I'm not sure he even realizes what he has done, like what is happening in that moment.
Mm-hmm. And he, I mean, certainly didn't deserve what happened to him.
Oh my gosh, no. Like, he is trying to protect himself, I think, mentally and physically, and he thinks the Darkling is the one that's going to be able to protect him the best.
But I don't know if we never really get a clear read on whether it was, like, a deliberate betrayal.
Right. I'm not sure if it was. Yeah, I don't know.
I like that was made unclear, that it didn't, like, directly vilify him as having been, like, a secret agent the whole time.
Right. And I think the way that we see him kind of, he's not dealing with his PTSD, but, like, kind of the symptoms of it are shown in ways that I think we often see women dealing with mental health issues. And I thought that was really interesting because we see him, like, crying and he's, like, huddled up, and I think we also often see depictions of women having mental health issues in that way and not really men. I think when we see men with mental health issues, we often see them like closing themselves off and pushing people away as opposed to actually...
Or anger.
Yeah, anger, violence, as opposed to actually like seeing them dealing with their emotions in any way.
And to be fair, the way Sergei's acting makes total sense after what he saw and what he experienced.
I mean, he literally sees... the woman he loves cut in half. I don't know that I'd be okay after that.
I don't
either.
Know if anyone could bounce back from that.
No. I don't think so.
Maybe he's the only one processing and everyone else is just pushing their emotions and experiences down in order to survive.
I'm sure if we had a fourth book, everyone would be having breakdowns all over the place.
It would just be therapy.
Just straight therapy. Years and years of therapy to deal with all of this.
I'm curious what you think about the following proposition. Do you think that we can equate or connect the urge, Alina and the Darkling's urge to use their power, to the disease of addiction? Because they feel this impulse towards it, and it seems like they're addicted to it, and they seem to get a high off of it. But at the same time, it like fortifies them. It doesn't deplete them. It's not like a drug in that same way.
Right. It makes them stronger.
Right.
Yeah, I see it. I think that is convincing in that they almost seem to have no control over that feeling of need to use
their power.
That's
what
I mean.
Yeah.
Right. I think in that is true. And I guess in a kind of way, we do see them. We don't see a depletion or like illness, or I don't think they're going to die from being addicted to this power. But I think maybe what we're supposed to see is the Darkling becomes more and more evil the way, like, the longer he uses his power, the longer he gives into those impulses. So maybe that's the way we're supposed to see how this addiction is bad.
Yeah, about how it has bad consequences.
Yeah.
Because he feels an impulse to use the fold.
Right.
To expand the fold.
Right. Which makes no sense. How are you going to be in charge of everyone if no one's left?
And it does... I mean, gets to the how their power kind of works. Alina and the Darkling's power works. It's this positive feedback loop,
right,
where the more they use the power, the more they want to use their power and the more powerful they actually become. So that means the next time, and then these effects just compound,
right,
every single time. It doesn't seem sustainable.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I did not think of that at all.
Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
Going on with this idea of their power and how the power works, I don't think Alina truly grapples with the fact that she's most likely immortal. And the book seems to suggest that immortality really messes with a person.
Well, it makes sense, because if you're immortal and you have to watch the people around you die, what's going to happen with her and Mal? Mal's not going to live forever.
No, I don't think she lives forever anymore that her power is gone.
I know that she's not now, but like, she didn't think about this at all.
Mm-mm. I think she was just focused on survival and winning.
That's true. Well, and now she doesn't have to worry about it.
Maybe this, like, the whole problem, the Darkling's problem with immortality and how he ends up dealing with it, maybe that's one of the reasons why I can get like the Alina's sympathy towards him, because I believe and was convinced that he felt some sort of like deep longing to not be alone anymore. I don't know if you found that convincing.
Oh, I did, definitely. I think that the Darkling wants someone. Oh, okay. I wrote it down, but I didn't put it in the notes. So, you know, in BBC Sherlock, if you haven't watched it, this is going to be spoilers. You know how in BBC Sherlock, Moriarty wants so bad for Sherlock to be similar to him, because he's like his one true like nemesis, kind of like the person he thinks that could go head to head with him, in maybe like it would actually be difficult for,
like,
the two
as
of them.
An equal.
Yeah, as an equal. I thought that Alina and the Darkling were like that, where the Darkling thought Alina could be his equal, and that's what he was looking for. Not in a like ridiculous kind of out of his mind trying to find someone and kill people kind of way, but like with Moriarty, but I think that is what he really wanted.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's my comparison for the two of them.
I hadn't thought about that.
I just really love Sherlock. But I also don't feel bad for Moriarty, and I don't feel bad for the Darkling.
Another thing that in the minds and bodies vein that came up for me when I was thinking about the episode notes is Bagra's story as yet another example of how the cycle of abuse continues and even magnifies over generations. So she's a little girl who's neglected by her father and feared/hated by her mother. And then Bagra ends up teaching her son that love is useless and makes people weak. And it makes logical sense why she should feel that way because of her own personal life experiences. But then she ends up regretting how she indoctrinated Alexander and understands that she played a pivotal role, if not the central role, in forming him into the Darkling.
Yeah, sometimes it gets kind of frustrating to see these stories for me of like these cycle of abuses because they often have no good ending where like the Darkling doesn't realize that he's a victim of the cycle of abuse, so he doesn't even have a chance to try and change things. And for me, I'm like, you know, sometimes people do get out of those cycles, and I was a little like, that's a little like,
because I think it's harder and way more complicated and messy to try and grapple with what healing would potentially look like.
Right. Yeah, it's work. It's a lot of work. But I think you're right. And I also feel that Bagra thinks that love makes people weak, but she also, in telling her story to Alina of the Darkling and how he came about, she doesn't try and find someone to love. It doesn't seem like she tells Alina, like, there's no love story here. I just wanted a child, so I had a child. So I'm not sure she even tries.
Yeah, I don't know if she does. Maybe she's so traumatized that she's just doesn't even give it a try.
Why do you think she wanted a child then?
To not be alone.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's a good reason to have a kid.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that her motivations are really not easy to untangle.
No. And we don't get enough of her backstory to even, I think, try to attempt to untangle them. Mm-hmm. Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take some liberties and do some shipping of our own. Nadia and Tamar are in a relationship, and we have gay characters, like solidly actually gay characters.
Yay!
I was real excited. That's all I have to say about them.
Finally.
I know. Yeah. And they're real cute. I don't know. I just like them. They're so different. I think it's why I like them together.
They are very cute. I'm going to bring up Darkling and Alina one more time. I'm curious what you think of their relationship and connection, because this was one of my favorite parts of this book. I loved how messy the connection, the Alina-Darkling connection was, and how they developed that in this book. And then I'm also curious how you feel about the ship out of, that's not canon, but I want to know what you think. particularly because I think we don't agree on it at all.
Yeah, I would like to sink this ship. You know, the problem is I don't feel that we get enough of the Darkling in any books past book one. So I feel no connection to him whatsoever. And I'm just like, no thanks. No thank you. I don't want Alina with anyone. There's no one in the book. And I'm like, yeah, Alina and that person. Just be by yourself and live a happy life with Misha and Oncat.
Just get a bunch of cats.
Yeah, it's the thing to do. What do you think about this ship?
You know what I think about it. I'm conflicted. I'm not as against it as I feel like I logically should be because of how terrible the Darkling is as a person. I don't know. I find him way more intriguing. And what does that say about me? I don't know. That was a hypothetical question. We don't have to answer
it. Okay. Oh, I'm so sorry. I was going to answer it, but I guess
I'm not sure I want to know the answer.
I was just going to say you have a thing for the bad guys.
Totally.
It's fine. And most of the time, I'm on board with that ship. I just really don't like the Darkling.
Okay, on to the other ship, the canon ship of this series. How am I supposed to feel when the only way Mal and Alina can be happy together is after Alina becomes Okazatsia again, aka after she loses her immense power? Like, how am I supposed to feel after that? Does this mean that deep love and understanding across and even because of difference is impossible?
I sure as hell hope not. See, I don't want Alina and Mal together either.
I mean, I'm glad she didn't end up alone, I guess, since this is what she wanted.
Yeah, she does get what she wants, but she talks about like having a place in her heart that is empty because she loses her power.
That's rough.
Yeah. She'll never get in the after part at the very end, they talk about the girl. Also, at this point, can we say the woman? Like, she's not a girl anymore. Let's age her up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But she's like standing and like running her hands through like beams of light, and that was
so sad.
Yeah. I don't know. I wish she didn't lose her power. Maybe just Mal loses his power.
Does he lose his power?
Yeah, he can't track things anymore.
Oh, okay. I didn't remember that.
So I didn't appreciate that. Oh, and now I'm concerned about what that might say about like racial and cultural differences and trying to bring them together.
I think it takes concerted effort, and Mal didn't make the effort.
No.
To understand her.
He didn't
when
want
she had
to.
Power.
And in that case, like, what does it say about the future of their relationship? He doesn't really care to get to know who she was when she was powerful. He tried to push her away. Ugh.
Yeah, I'm not a Mal fan personally, but glad Alina lived happily ever after.
Do they have a ship name?
Melina?
Sexy times.
There was a lot of Melina tension in the first two-thirds of the book. Basically until we find out Mal's the third amplifier, and then they're both like, fuck it, and get together.
But also their get-together, like, they have sex, but we don't get to see it.
Classic fade-out.
Very much.
Maybe we're just, like, voyeurs.
I don't know what's wrong with us. I don't know.
Nothing. This is a sex-positive podcast.
Yeah, nothing's wrong with us. I just am like, if they want to have sex and they're going to have sex, just show us the sex. Yeah, I was like, I don't really care.
I mean, glad that Mal finally stopped being like this self-sacrificing a-hole.
But I'm not sure that he didn't have sex with her because he was like, I'm going to die anyways. Might as well
get some.
Yeah. And in which case I'm like, are those good intentions? I don't know.
Well, Alina was like, well, I'm going to have to kill you, so might as well get some.
Well, she didn't think she was going to have to kill him, so she was hoping not to have to.
But just in case, but contingency
just in case,
plan.
I better have sex with this dude. I respect that contingency plan.
Yep. Good for her.
Do what you gotta do, girl.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else we want in a segment called Kill Your Darlings.
So Mal did not actually die. And this is something that sometimes frustrates with me with YA. They raise the stakes so high. Like, Mal's going to die. He's dead. He's not coming back.
Alina's going to be alone forever and have to live with the fact that she killed her one true love.
Yeah. And then they just take it back. And I don't like it. And now I think, well, how come you guys didn't try and bring back those other people that died? That's real shitty. Don't raise the stakes if you're not gonna follow through.
You're so ruthless. Cutthroat.
Literally kill your darlings. Like, that is where that phrase comes from. Like, like, just do it, man. No, no.
It would certainly be an entirely different book/series. If Mal actually stayed dead.
Yeah. I think it would be okay. I don't know. I'm not really sure what I wanted for Alina in the end.
That's the thing is, I agree with you. I didn't have a clear read on myself and my own emotions and how I wanted things to end up.
Yeah. I wish I would have like stopped reading before he came back to life so that I could know how I felt about his death and Alina possibly being alone forever.
But forget about it. At that point, you're like, I gotta get through these
last
pages.
Then I'm like, I gotta know what's gonna happen. But when Mal got brought back, I think that was my most disappointing part in the whole book.
Hmm.
I was just like, why would you do that?
Hmm.
Also, is he a zombie now? Zombie Mal. Yeah,
That seems to be, like, how is that then an okay thing to do? Like, where's the line with Marzost then?
I know.
All of a sudden, like, it doesn't apply when you like the person?
Well, because we've made such a big deal through the whole book about Bagra's, or about Morozova bringing back his daughter. I don't know. I was just annoyed.
It seems to imply that, like, some people deserve to die and others don't.
Right. Yeah. I just wasn't on board.
I don't know.
That's all I have to say for Kill Your Darlings.
For this book, I liked the pacing. I thought it was pretty good. There's a lot of traveling around. The tunnels were a little tiresome for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's the part I was least, like, bored.
I also thought that we saw more group dynamics, which was fun.
I really liked getting to know Zoya and Marsha.
I like Zoya so much.
I do, too.
She's a POV in King of Scars, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes me exciting.
I think Jenya is, too, actually.
Oh, in King of Scars.
King of Scars, yeah.
Do you think Zoya and Nikolai will end up together?
I don't know. That almost seems too easy.
It does seem too easy, but wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. As far as other things for Kill Your Darlings, I think that that Bardugo really developed over the series as far as being able to, as far as the intricacy of the plot structure and how many threads ended up being woven back together. And the twists that I didn't see coming, there were way more twists in this book that I didn't expect than in previous books.
Mostly I didn't expect Mal to be the third amplifier, or for him to come back from the dead, or for Elena to kill him.
Or for Bagra's suicide.
Right, no, I did not see that coming.
Or for the Nikolai stuff.
Right. The Nikolai stuff seemed really, I didn't think about it at the time, but it seemed really strange. And all I could think of is like Rhysand when he turns into like his full monster kind of person thing. And I was just like, oh, this is weird.
I imagine Nikolai is like a sort of gargoyle. Remember that cartoon Gargoyles?
Yeah.
That's what I imagined him looking like.
All right. Well, I imagine him as Rhysand and you imagine him as a gargoyle. Very different.
Very. Another thing I really liked is the addition of the folklore.
Right.
You get a little bit more of like that sort of mystical, sort of uncanny, strange storytelling tradition.
Right.
That then she develops more because she released Language of Thorns, the series of short stories based on the folktales of the Grishaverse.
Have you read them?
I have. It's good. Really good. It's illustrated too. The illustrations are amazing.
Ooh. I also thought there was, when they were in that, I don't know where they were, there was like all the trees. Like there was like
a Sikorzoi?
Maybe.
In the south?
Yeah, and they were like the trees, and they said somebody planted like the ashes. Okay.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
That part really freaked me out. I'm not sure how, if it was supposed to be scary or not, but I was like, this is really creepy. So maybe she should write some horror stuff.
Yeah, that's what
I wouldn't read it.
The
but.
Language of Thorns stuff is way more dark that way.
Okay.
Which I really liked.
Like really dark? Am I going to be scared?
Not really. No, no, no.
Okay.
You wouldn't be scared, but it's not as, I said the characters do dark things and it's more complicated rather than just the good versus evil.
Okay.
Which is a lot, kind of more how Grimm's fairy tales work.
Okay, I was going to ask, is it like Grimm's fairy tales?
Yeah, it's a little bit more grotesque. And
okay.
I think that Bardugo really shines then in those stories.
Then I could read that. Recommend if you like the other two books.
If you're prepping, if you're pre-gaming for King of Scars, I would say read this series.
Yeah. I really just want King of Scars now. When does it come out? Do you know?
2019. Don't know when. Is it January?
I want to say
it
January.
It can't be. I would be flipping out too much. Maybe I need to look it up.
I think it might be January. We'll find out.
January 29th, 2019.
Okay. Okay, so we have like about 2 months.
2 months too many.
If you like travel stories... which it turns out so not I do Jessie. Not I didn't know that about myself until I read this book. Before we end, it's time for real talk. Did reading this book make your perspective change in any way, or did it make you interrogate a concept, system, trend you hadn't had before?
For me, the biggest takeaway would be this Bagra Alexander Darkling story that makes me think about the hard work of healing intergenerational trauma. What about you?
I think I probably thought about that and along those same lines, but mostly about how we don't really get stories about people dealing with and coming through to the other side of the cycles of abuse in a positive way. I think I need that book.
Let's write it.
I know. Can we just write it ourselves? What you should do, right?
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of A Reaper at the Gates by Saba Tahir. And watch out for the occasional mini-sode about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics.
You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post a tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on Apple Podcasts, Google Play /podcasts, and Stitcher. And please rate and review the show. It helps other listeners find us. JK It's Magic is recorded on land traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native peoples. See you in a fortnight.
That was all recorded.
Oh, I didn't realize you started recording. Excellent.
Yeah. Excellent. Leave it in.